Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome again to The Hobcast Book Show. It is show number 55. Wow. We say that every week, don't we?
No, we don't. We say 54, 53.
Well, something like that. Welcome to the show. And let us introduce ourselves quickly, and then we'll talk about who's coming up later in the programme. But first of all, I'm Adrian Hobart.
I'm Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hoback Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Thrillers.
Crime.
Mystery.
And suspense. And we've had a bonkers week. It's always a bonkers week, but I'm surprised you've got the energy to do the show this week.
Yeah, I confess I'm feeling a tiny bit delicate today, partly through consumption of wine.
Yeah.
And lack of sleep and dancing and general merriment of last night.
Yeah. Just to fill in the blanks on that, it was your father's and his wife's, that's Mike and Faye,
yeah,
their Ruby wedding anniversary party at a rather swish golf club outside Stafford. And there was the wonderful Lola Lamour performing. And she does. She's a fan of everything vintage, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Great singer and fan of the fashions. Lives her life as if she's in the 50s.
Yeah. So they don't own a TV, and they do. Their house is decorated, and everything is set up as if it's the 1950s. Although they do use the internet.
Yeah, of course. I mean, she's got a great website, but she doesn't have a TV. So there you go. Anyway, it was a great party, and I only crawled in with two of your boys at about 9:30 after one of our two cars, one's off the road already, the other one just gave up in the middle of Stockport.
So Josh and I, Josh the middle boy, the one who doesn't like football, we were lucky enough to get a lift there, and we started drinking quite early on. And
Middle boy is how old? Nearly 18, approaching 18.
Oh, ish. Anyway.
Yeah, not long.
But I was very impressed, though, because Lola Lamour, one part of her act is to get people to join in some form or other.
Yep.
And you got up.
I did.
With Josh. And my dad.
Yes.
As three backing singers.
Yeah.
On what was the song you sang?
Chanson Lamour.
Yes. It was brilliant.
By the Manhattan Transfer.
Now, see, Josh had never heard this song before, but all he had to do was rat-a-tat-a-tat over and over again.
Rat-a-tat-a-tat.
Oh, is it not rat-a-tat-a-tat?
No, it's not.
Okay.
Yeah, he did a great job. And indeed, another member of your family got up. In fact,
two
your stepbrothers.
Yeah, so I have got four stepbrothers. It's a very male-dominated family.
And I can never remember their names, but I remember John. Got a very good voice,
so John is the oldest. He's very tall. So when I was 10 years old, the first time I met him, and he was 18, I remember looking up and up and up and up and up and thinking, wow. He's not quite so tall relative to me now, but he's still tall.
Yeah.
So he got up to do a backing singing session with his younger brother, Dave.
Dave, yeah. Now, the singer, Lola, said, "I know your face from somewhere."
To Dave.
To Dave. And the audience, well, you should do. Who do you look like? And I shouted out, himself, because your stepbrother is?
Dave Gorman.
Dave Gorman. For listeners of the show of a certain age, an absolute hero to anyone with a love of ephemera facts, a very humorous guy, one of, you know, absolute stalwart of Dave TV and BBC Two and all sorts of shows.
Yeah, he's done Radio 4,
he's done really well. He's one of Britain's most beloved comics, and his tours sell out very quickly. So there you go, he was there up on stage. In fact, I'll tell you what we're going to do.
I'll play you a few seconds of the brothers and Lola the Moor in action.
But John, the older brother, he had an amazing voice.
Yeah, he does
didn't
have an amazing voice. He does.
And his moves too. He was sort of sliding across the floor and all sorts.
He obviously was in the Royal Navy. You say
he was in the Royal Navy.
How does someone that height work in the Royal Navy and go on ships with the tiny coffin bunks that they
get? Don't know.
My word, he must have been in, stooped the whole time of his service. Anyway, it was a lovely evening, and I will play you a few seconds from the video of them in action. Dave Gorman, John Gorman, and Lola L'Amour.
Yes.
She's available for weddings and all sorts. In fact, we might even book her for our own.
She's brilliant. I mean, I
was really impressed.
When I heard it was a vintage singer, I first thought, I'm not going to know many of the songs.
She was superb.
But I knew them all, and she was brilliant. She worked the room. She walked around the room.
Very funny.
She was a comedian herself, actually, I think. She was really good.
And she plays up on the glamour element, and I have to say, from a man's point of view, We'll leave it there. Let's talk about our guest this week. We're looking forward to speaking to Andy Hill a little bit later. AJ Hill, as he writes. And Andy first submitted to us just over a year ago or so, and was one of the unlucky ones that we rejected. And it was really, it was a close run thing.
Yeah,
very close.
But
subsequently, dusted himself down, and he's been signed by Spellbound. And his first book came out, a week today that we record this podcast, last week.
So we spoke to him on publication day.
Dead Drift is the book. It's published by Spellbound, as we say, and Andy will be joining us later. And he is officially the nicest person on the, when you go to a circuit event like Harrogate, where we met him first, he's really one of the nicest people you'll ever
meet. He's lovely. He's so down to earth, isn't he? And he's absolutely so willing to talk to anybody. He's a great guy.
And I think there's a big audience out there just wishing him well and hoping that...
Yeah, we do too.
Absolutely. Didn't work out for us, but... we wish him every success, and of course Spellbound as well. And we look forward to seeing them at future festivals and sharing a drink and talking about the trials and tribulations of running
the joys of publishing,
running an independent publisher, which is what we do. Let's get into some news. There's so many good stories around, and I want to first of all let's look at the big headline story from the bookseller this week, which was looking at the ebook market for the big six publishers in the UK. Now, those big six are, I'm trying to do this from memory.
Go on then.
HarperCollins, Hachette, Penguin Random House, Bloomsbury, Simon & Schuster, and Pan Macmillan.
Yes, perfect.
Right, and number one in that list of terms of sales of ebooks are Hachette. And one of the things they did is they bought Bookature.
Yes, they did, yes.
About four years ago.
Yeah.
And so they've adopted a lot of the digital know-how. Obviously, they've got the titles that came with it and some of the people. But they've adopted a much more indie approach to selling ebooks, and that's really benefited them. But the overall headline was that the entire ebook market dropped by 16% last year, year-on-year sales. And only one of those publishers had a positive growth, and that was Bloomsbury.
Yes.
Who I believe have bought Head of Zeus.
They did. They bought Head of Zeus, I think it was a couple of years ago now.
Yeah, and that's reflected in their growth digitally, where they weren't in this chart at all 3 years ago.
No.
So, it's a growth on what? They didn't... Because don't forget, even though they are the publishers of the physical copies of Harry Potter series in the UK, they are not... They didn't sign J.K. Rowling for the digital rights. They let her have those digital rights. And it's still consistently, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, et cetera, is still a top 10 ebook. Year on year on year on year.
It was a different time, wasn't it?
They just didn't. But they were snobbish. Let's be honest about it. Everybody
was snobbish.
I don't
think it's just snobbery. I think it's, they just think it's not a moneymaker. They didn't think it was a moneymaker at that time.
It's a long time ago. I confess, but they didn't sign it. So she's always, that's one of the reasons she is as wealthy as she is, because, those ebooks are worth an absolute ton. Obviously, the film rights and everything else went for a lot of money, and all the merchandise and everything that she gets a share of. Anyway, the other publishers have struggled with the ebook situation. And that is partly a reflection of just how many ebooks were sold in 2020, the first year of the pandemic. And that sort of surge, just as we were setting up, really, and releasing our first books. So we haven't felt that sort of wave of either drop-off or sudden surge of growth.
No, we
weren't in a position to exploit that. But it's interesting that there's been this significant dip.
Personally, my theory is, and I have no basis on this, but when lockdown started, yes, people turned to ebooks because suddenly they thought, oh, I can't go to buy physical books.
Can't even get out of the house practically.
But then they got to a point where, firstly, they got fed up of looking at a screen because that's all we did all day was
work
look
from
at a screen.
Home and then look at a screen.
And so
reading
a paperback, it's a relaxing activity compared to reading a screen. And secondly, if it started to feel like a treat, you might order a book to be delivered to you, or when the bookshop's open, you go out and you go to a bookshop because you haven't been for 6 months or so, and you know you suddenly go, oh,
you buy
real
a stack
books.
Of them,
and it's that sort of tactileness of a physical book that I think we felt we'd missed for the first few months of lockdown.
Yeah, that's true. We'll talk about this later because we're going to reflect on we've been interacting on Facebook with the biggest group of crime fans on the Facebook platform in the UK, and asking questions about that and something else I asked this morning, which went a bit bonkers. So if I drift off, it's probably because I'm answering yet more comments on the subject. So that's interesting. That's the publishing side of things. Now, on the retail side of things, we're really a little sad to hear this, but the family who've owned Blackwell's Books, based in Oxford, and indeed Heffer's, which is the Cambridge academic bookshop, and in fact they had a whole heap of bookshops when I was growing up, different types of bookshop. They are selling up after 140 years in charge, and they had hoped to sell the chain and their business to their own employees.
Mm.
And we were in Blackwell's just, 4 weeks ago, maybe?
Yeah, it was only a month.
Yeah. And we went down Broad Street into Blackwell's, their big sort of headline sort of shop opposite the Sheldonian Theatre.
It's massive, isn't it?
It is massive.
Oh, it's lovely.
And it's got such a great atmosphere. It's got a slightly higgledy-piggledy nature of it, but it is great. And the staff are incredibly knowledgeable. Just brilliant. But it's being sold. And so the thought is that it's most likely that Waterstones are going to steam in and take it.
I'm very fond of Waterstones, but my reaction just now when you said that was just sort of like, just because Blackwell's is different from Waterstones.
It is.
It has
its
own culture, its own atmosphere, its own...
Look, Waterstones do a great job of keeping high street retailing the books up. And I've never been, and I want to go to the Bradford one, which is the most extraordinary building ever. It's a bit like the John Rylands Library in Manchester, but a bookshop. It's fabulous. I'm sure some of our listeners know it. I keep seeing it on social media, you know.
Well, the Birmingham one used to be very grand. In the centre of Birmingham, it's now an Apple store, but it used to be Waterstones.
Right. Yeah, it's a sort of neoclassical building, isn't it, if I remember rightly. But Waterstones, it's owned by a massive hedge fund, so in the States. So it's quite aggressive. And let's be honest, the individual staff who work at Waterstones, in fact, many of the people who work there, they're passionate about books. And I know a store manager back in Kent who I was at university with, passionate about books. But it's not quite the same as the Blackwell's philosophy.
Yeah, just the impression I get from the staff in Blackwell's is they live, breathe, eat everything books. You ask them anything and they will know something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also sort of an intellectual level that they seem to have an edge over. So I hope they don't lose that, whatever happens to Blackwell's and Heffer's.
Absolutely. So that's currently out there in the marketplace. We're not in a position to buy it at the moment.
Oh, well,
maybe
not.
No. Strangely enough. But one day. And then we'll make it just an independent publishing bookshop.
I'll just live in there.
Someone should do that.
Yeah.
Someone needs to do that. In fact, let's do that.
I like your snap decisions. Yeah, let's just do it.
No, okay. Here's a thought. This is my snap decision, and I am conscious of time because we've got to get one more news story in before we get to Andy. And we've got 6 minutes in which to do it. Why don't we get a marquee? We put it up in the middle of Harrogate during the festival, and we just have an indie festival bookshop. So all of the indie publishers that aren't being picked up for speaking events We could just, you know, it won't be very far. There's a bit of greenery nearby. We could set up a little pop-up.
I think we should do it in Norbury.
Yeah, that might be a struggle. I mean, you've seen the sort of books they sell in the canal shop.
Yes, well, they're about canals, aren't they?
Yeah,
and barges.
They are. They are. That's all it's ever about. Anyway, we've got one more final story to talk about. And this involves Val McDermid. You may have seen this story, but she has until recently been a sponsor of Raith Rovers, her local football club in Scotland. And she withdrew her sponsorship support because the club signed in the January transfer window a player called David Goodwillie, who had
Is that
been,
his real name?
Yeah. He'd been found guilty in a civil case, not a Crown prosecution case or, you know, Crown against him, of rape. And it just has totally imploded on the club. They have now said that he will not play for the club ever, and they're going to terminate his contract. But Val was the first to really sort of flag this up and pull her support out. So I don't know how much her support is worth. It's probably worth a fair bit for a club as small as Raith Rovers. But, you know, she's stuck to her principles and acted quickly.
But if he's not to play for that club, why is she withdrawing her support from the club?
I don't know whether she's now going to put the money back in, but the fact is that she probably, I mean, you know, is shaken by a club that was prepared to sign him in the first place. So there is an interesting... I mean, I think that's still to be...
Well, just,
you know,
yeah.
Keep watching that space, but that has been the talk of many of the papers.
Well, there's a lot of badly behaved footballers out at the moment, aren't there? So
Yeah, and funnily enough, I mean, not funnily, it's not funny at all. We're referring to, of course, the story of Mason Greenwood. Now, we're not going to say much more than that, but the club, Manchester United, my club, I have a Mason Greenwood shirt I bought before the season started, and they've actually offered me a complete swap so I can send it back and choose another player. But the trouble is, A, I think they're all a shower at the moment because they're playing really badly. And my other shirt is a Ronaldo shirt, and he was facing similar allegations in Las Vegas not so long ago.
I've just had an idea.
What's that?
You could have it replaced with Hoback Books. I think when you go to a football match, you're advertising us.
Oh, that's true. Actually, I'd rather have Aki written on the back.
Aki Cat.
Aki Cat, yeah. yeah, but that's what they're offering. And yeah, my favourite other player has just left the club for a loan move to Everton. So
remind me who that is.
That's Donny van de Beek.
Oh, I don't know that one.
No, I haven't told you that one.
Donny van de Beek.
He never plays.
Oh, okay.
Which is why he's left. But I really admire him. I think he's a fantastic player, and I think it's scandalous he's not been used. So yeah, at the moment it's hard to pick a player.
Aki Cat it is, then.
Aki Cat it is. All right, well, let's get to our special guest this week, Andy Hill, with his debut book, debut novel, Dead Drift, which has come out with Spellbound last week. And it's been a long sort of week for him with the blog tour. And
oh, he's been busy, hasn't
yeah,
he? We've
has.
Seen quite a few social media.
Absolutely. And as I say, we've met Andy... I had this very awkward conversation with Andy, actually, at Harrogate. I was sitting next to this, you know, he was with some of the people we'd met at Harrogate and been making friends with, like Linda Checkley and, Donna Morfitt and people
Dee,
like that. And Dee Grucock, yeah. And he was sitting there at the table and we started chatting amiably. And I thought this guy looks a bit like Paul Nichols.
Paul Nichols, yes.
From
Just Good Friends.
Just Good Friends, yeah.
So you asked him where Penny was.
I didn't know. I said, I'm sorry, we've not met. My name's Adrian. He said, I know who you are. I went, hang on, you're Andy Hill, aren't you? I went, oh, I'm so sorry. We turned you down only a matter of weeks before that. So,
But he was so good-natured, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was absolutely a delight and very kind. So we are delighted to invite him onto the show, and let's speak too, from his home in Sussex, Andy Hill. Andy Hill, thank you so much for joining us, because this is a really special day. It's publication day for you.
It is a bit surreal, because this is my first ever publication day, and I suspect it's a little bit like having your first child. It might be 30-odd years since my eldest daughter was born, but I distinctly remember sort of wandering around in a vague daze for at least 24 hours, and that's how it's kind of affecting me at the moment. Yeah, a bit unreal.
It's such a wonderful thing. I mean, from us as perspective as publishers, we love bringing people to print for the first time. I've not done it really. We've done two short stories between us,
yes,
or each.
Yeah,
and that's exciting enough. But to bring a full novel to the world is something else, isn't it?
It's funny. I was chatting with on Messenger with a friend of mine who is an old scuba diving buddy who actually produces short movies with regard to sort of diving around Gozo and Malta, which is where he lives now. And he was saying to produce a decent quality movie and put the music on is a bit of blood, sweat and tears. He said, I cannot imagine what putting a novel together is like. You live with the characters for that period of time. I guess the interesting thing is that I've always tried to listen, you know, to my editor, particularly Katie Forster, who has never given me a bum steer. She was really insightful. And I think that element of trying not to be precious about what you do, take on board what people with a more objective point of view can give to you, because you do get so, you know, I mean, the characters in the book to me, because I've lived with them so long and they're going to be part of a series, are, you know, effectively real people to me. So, you know, it does feel, when you're doing edits, it does feel a little bit sometimes like you're killing your children.
That's true.
That's an interesting way to see it, isn't it? Because, yeah, we have experience of, we give editorial feedback either from an editor or ourselves to an author. And there's always that moment of, if it's quite extensive, so not necessarily bad feedback, but it's suggesting a big change, we have that sort of feeling of, hold your breath, how are they going to react?
Yeah, and I think you put it very politely. I call it an oh shit moment. And it very much happened with Dead Drift, in that that I thought I was coming to the end of what I thought was the final draft, and I was just about to send the last few chapters over to KT, my editor, and she contacted me and said, there's a character in the book, Jem, who is a female character now, but started life as a male character. And she came back to me and said, do you think Dom, which was the name of the character at the time, might be better as female? And it's not something that I hadn't considered previously, but I didn't, I went back to her and said, if you feel it's the right move and it's not just a tick box exercise, then I'm not afraid of doing the work. And trust me, it was a shitload of work. But it really was worthwhile. And one of the things that she asked me to do was to do a character profile of the new, of this new character, and write a few hundred words, which I then sent off to her. And then she rang me back sort of 24 hours later, laughing at me down the phone because I basically stitched myself up, which I kind of felt that I had. And as I was doing the rewrites and the edits, I just found myself giving that character some extra bits and pieces to do, which was, it just shows the right move completely.
Did you begin that editing relationship with her before you joined Spellbound, or is this through Spellbound?
No, this was before. So the MS, the manuscript had been written. And then another writer friend of mine, John Marley, J.A. Marley, recommended Katie as an editor, and so I went and had a meeting with her, and we got on, and there was I felt that this was somebody who would be really useful as part and parcel of the collaborative process, and got the characters. She really sorted the manuscript out, and the problem is with when you're a debut writer is that you're kind of mentally writing towards this target figure. So, you know, there's lots of descriptive filler, mm-hmm. and she trimmed probably about 10,000 words out of the finished manuscript and guided me with some other bits and pieces in terms of, you need to sort of ramp this up, or you need to take this down, or that. She was a terrific help to me. The manuscripts that I sent out at the 12 months ago were the edited ones she really sort of helped me with.
I look at some of the stuff I've been working on, and this is the thing I find difficult, is that I'm trying to move a character from one place to the other. And I find it really hard not to describe what, that journey and try and sort of give it some meaning, where actually you can cut scenes. People are so used to just jumping between things. You don't need to, in my character's case, describe for the fifth time in the book his walk across Hyde Park.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I was listening yesterday to a podcast and they were talking about this very thing, saying that often when people start writing, they think they have to describe everything. And they're saying, but if your character is at a train station and they're saying, I'm on my way home, and then the next scene, they're home, the reader knows that they've been on that train. They haven't time traveled to get.
True.
So
true.
You don't, yeah. You know, there's certain things that you actually really do not need to describe, but it's a difficult thing to get in your head, I think, when you start.
Yeah, I'm still struggling with that.
There was an old joke, wasn't there, about the difference between an American writer and an English writer, and the American writer, man walks into a bar, and the English writer, you know, it was a 16th century bar, you know, it's an 18th century bar with flagstone floor, and they were selling these beers. And from my point of view, there was a necessary amount of description that was needed, because the New Forest, where the book is set, is very much a character within the book. But there are people who are going to read the book who've been to the New Forest. And obviously the idea is that if they've been to the New Forest, there is going to be one or two places that they actually recognise in there and can actually feel themselves within that. And yeah, you know, the interesting thing was on the run up to publication day today, there's been about half a dozen or so little small videos that I've dropped with the help of Spellbound over the last week, because it's set in real places in the New Forest. There's just little vignettes that were recorded at Conan Doyle's graveside on the River Test and in Lyndhurst and one or two other places that hopefully will give people a sense of Jack, the main protagonist's world, being part of the real world.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, as you say, a lot of people have traveled, but then you're going to, for a book to be successful, it's going to have international appeal. So giving people the context of where something's set, I think, is really important. And they can judge whether you've captured it in your work by what you put up online. I think that's very true.
And it gives them, yes, it sort of puts the images in their head. And also, like what you said about that place is a character. And this has come up quite a lot in interviews we've done, isn't it? When the writer said that the place is just as important as all the people in the book. And I think that's very important.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Mike Craven's Tilly and Poe books, you know, you really get the feel of Cumbria, you know, when they're talking, you know, when he's talking about Poe living in the middle of nowhere. And yeah, you know, I think if you're looking at Rankin, there you are with Rebus walking the streets of Edinburgh, and you really want to have that feel of walking with the character through the city or through the countryside, whatever it may be.
You didn't consider, which a lot of people have done, it's based on where they might live, and they didn't want to necessarily mention places by name,
like a slightly fictionalized version of
the area in which they're writing about. You felt comfortable going for
I did, because I mean, and part of it was that I had a little look and saw that there wasn't that much crime fiction based in the New Forest other than Matt Arledge's Eeny Meeny series. And Matt, in actual fact, is sort of a little vague about where it is in the New Forest. If you know the forest well, you can make assumptions and sort of tie it down. But if you're not acquainted with the New Forest, then you wouldn't necessarily know where it is. Whereas I thought, no, damn it, I'm going to be really specific. I've changed one or two things in terms of the Indian restaurant in Lyndhurst is not called by that name. It's actually called A Passage to India. And the local pub isn't called the Blue Lamp, even though it's only 40 yards away from the local Nick. It's actually called the Waterloo Arms. You know, I wanted the fact that there are millions and millions of people who go and have a day trip to the New Forest every year. And I wanted them to be able to immediately relate to exactly where it was. So when they're, you know, if I'm lucky enough to have a reader who's driving through Lyndhurst, they can go, wow, this is where Jack Lunn lives. I write as AJ Hill, but I don't have a middle name. And when I was talking it over with the publishers, and initials seemed to be a bit of a thing at the moment with a lot of authors. And they said, oh, you know, how about initials? What's your second name? And I said, well, I don't have a second name. My parents came from Yorkshire and Lancashire and were too mean to buy me a second name. Being sensible northern folk and fond of a penny, they said, well, okay, so what was your dad's name? And I said, his name was Albert, but I can't be A.A. Hill, too close to A.A. Gill or A.A. Neil.
Exactly, yeah, it's the first thing you think of, isn't it?
So they said, you know, what about a nickname? And my nickname at school was Jack. And so that's where the J came from. But it's also where Jack's name came from. And then the Lun is there's a fly pattern called Lun's Particular. So I just ruthlessly stole the Lun from there. And I just thought it was quite nice and short and punchy and not complicated. So, yeah, that worked for me.
Now, that's a very good point, isn't it? Because we've come across names. Authors have given their characters names that you can't you stumble over each time you try and read it.
Yeah, we've got one where it's a very strong Irish name, but I actually had to go and start looking up and how you
yeah.
Because in my head, I couldn't read the manuscript and get anywhere near how it should be pronounced. So it is a check. Yeah, Jack Lund. That has got a good Anglo-Saxon sort of, yeah, no nonsense kind of appeal to it, I think. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Let's touch on that, on your career path, because it's you know, I think, would it be unfair to say you've had a bit of a portfolio career over the years in terms of you've done various things and maybe moved on every decade or something different?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked in property for the last sort of 30 plus years now, but my, I went from university into Her Majesty's Customs and Excise and worked in VAT for about 18 months and then in uniform on Rummage Cruise and Mobile Task Forces for about 3.5 years. And I got engaged towards the end of that period. And part of that process was then to find something that gave me more regular hours, because particularly on Rummage Crew, you're on 24-hour call out. And so that's why I ventured into the police. And, you know, I only lasted a couple of, less than a couple of years there, or coming up on a couple of years. But my experience within it has left me with nothing but admiration for the work that they do. And whilst it wasn't for me, particularly the police these days, they have such an unbelievably more difficult job than I ever had back in the days of a wooden truncheon and a top hat. And literally you had to run with one hand on your helmet and the other hand on your radio, because both would fly off otherwise. There was no stab vests and ASPs and tasers and stuff like that back in my day, and no computers.
Didn't police have a whistle?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
They had a whistle. And that's what the police boxes were for. So.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
They saw something and they needed backup, they would go and use the phone. Yeah,
you know, you knew all the taxi offices to go to where you could get a free cup of tea and sit and have a smoke quietly. So you know, you get to know these things. And I was stationed down in Dorset, which was pretty quiet during the winter, but really busy during the summer.
Sure.
But then I worked in retail for a little while, and I actually qualified as a mortgage advisor, but actually found out that I enjoyed selling houses to people more, and worked for 14 years as an estate agent, and then got my soul back and moved into property management. And I worked for a big company that are based up in London with large investment landlords like Guy's and St. Thomas's Foundation. Yeah, they're a good company to work for. And I spent the last basically 2 years working from home.
Of course.
So you can write in your free time.
Well, that's the, I've got to be honest, Rebecca, it's a two-edged sword in terms of, I 5 days a week, I spend 8-9 hours parked in front of a laptop and screen working. And to then try and write afterwards can be really, really difficult.
Yeah.
Whereas I'd come away from my office in Brighton, drive across the Downs, leave all of that baggage behind and be able to come home and actually write for an hour or two. It's that's getting that separation is really quite difficult at times. So, yeah, I live in a little cottage in the middle of nowhere on a quiet lane where, to be honest, I get more horses going past than I do cars. And my garden, I literally can turn my head and see the birds on my bird feeders. I've got fields and then woods beyond. And there's no street lighting or anything down here. Mm-hmm. And the thing that woke me up this morning was actually the pheasants in the field opposite croaking away.
Now, in terms of, you know, drawing together all those things you've done, how much do they inform the characters in terms of Jack and the other people that the world you've created?
Oh gosh, well, you know, I think there's a good proportion, there's a good portion of me in Jack. That's the first thing that I would say. I've stuck him with a divorce. I've stuck him with a dodgy knee, and the joke is that I'm twice the man that he is because I've had two divorces and both my knees are dodgy. So, but you know, the fly fishing thing that is his kind of recreational passion is certainly a passion of mine too. I don't tie flies like he and Jem do, but I really enjoy my fly fishing. So that was something. And indeed, you know, he loves to cook and I love to cook. So there was that part of it, and him living in a place that I'd lived. Other aspects, no. I wasn't in the force. I wasn't a detective. For that period of time, I think he's more single-minded than I am. I think he and you know, that can be seen as both a strength and a weakness. There's this sort of idea that all of them have to be flawed characters. Well, the reality is we're all flawed characters. We're all flawed people. Mm-hmm. You're never going to present a protagonist that's perfect. And Jack is, you know, Jack is not perfect. He has some wonder, you know, he has some lovely qualities, but he's also, he can be completely blinkered at times. That was kind of my motivation for him having some character aspects and flaws that are mine, makes him easier to write and hopefully makes the particularly the exposition and banter between him and the some of the other characters a bit more realistic.
Yeah,
because you can imagine yourself, even though you're not the same person, but you can imagine yourself in that situation and what you'd say and how you'd react to some degree.
Exactly that.
I have a random question. It's not the random question.
Two random questions.
Do you own a copy of Fly Fishing by J.R.R. Hartley?
I do not, but I do own several fly fishing books. There was not as many as books as I do cookbooks. I own
about
a lot
the complete
of
angler.
Yeah, Isaac Walton.
Because Isaac Walton was from very close to where we live.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, we used to pass his.
He was indeed.
You could visit his cottage.
Neither of those do I own, but I do own a number of other. They're more to do with fly fishing and techniques and stuff like that, because I bought them when I was starting to learn.
We've rubbed shoulders at Harrogate. We met for the first time, and you know. And have you been sort of regular at the festival scene? I got the impression you had, but
that was only my second time to Harrogate. But Crime Fest was, you know, I think in probably in about 10 or 11 years, I've only ever missed two Crime Fests. And it was the first big one that I went to. And I loved it so much. And yet the first time I went, I was like, nobody's going to talk to me. You know, authors are all going to be, you know, standoffish and you know, unless, you know, it's going to be very clicky and whatever. But the thing I found out, particularly about the crime and thriller bunch, is that they are the most warm, friendly crowd. And you know, my theory is that all the anger and hate is on the page and what's left is the love.
So how will it feel come May? Is it May?
Crime Fest,
yeah. Are you going to this one?
Yeah, I'm already booked. Yeah.
How will it feel walking in as a published author? That's going to feel.
It will feel a bit odd, and I guess because they had to cancel last year, they've held a lot of the panels over, So the chances, you know, the chances of me getting a panel there are zero, which is a shame because it would have been lovely to have got a to be a debut author and got a panel there. But, you know, to actually walk in as a published author will be an extraordinary thing. And I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago, and they said, you know, oh, you know, if it was anybody in the, you know, anybody at all to read your book, who would you want to read your book? And it would be my dad. I mean, you know, my dad would be the person that I would have wanted to have read my book. And he was a headmaster. He was a very good sportsman, and I was a decent sportsman, played rugby for the county and South of England trials and all that kind of stuff. And he would have been pretty chuffed with the sporting achievements. But I think to have been a published author really would have given him a buzz.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think it's time for you to face the ultimate challenge in the interview.
Right.
And I'm going to give it the build-up, okay? And sometime at this time this week, I'm going to put reverb on it, so it's going to sound really dramatic, okay?
But I'll, very
here
exciting.
We go. Here we go.
Rebecca's random question:
what is the one song that gets you on the dance floor more than any other song?
With Dodgy Knees.
I think this one is a classic that pretty much anybody, particularly of my age group, and I suspect of yours as well, would instantly recognise and be able to do it. Oops, upside your head.
Yeah, just about. Yeah. Good. I'd probably have to wait a minute for people doing it, and then I'd get back into the rhythm of it.
But yeah. But everybody knows it as the rowing boat song. But
right.
Yeah.
I think that one particularly, there are so many though. Clubs weren't clubs when I went clubbing. They were discos. Yes. So that tells you how old I am. You know, there were some great tunes out there. But I think there's, you know, even now, there's still some great tunes out there. But, I can go Faithless, anything by Faithless. Yeah, I'm up there. I like a bit of club, you know, sort of 90s, early 2000 clubbing music. I think anything really that's got an infectious beat and just gets you going. Funny enough, we were talking the other day about artists, and we touched briefly on Neil Young taking his stuff off Spotify, and I'm a big Neil Young fan.
Yeah.
And back what he's done. I'm actually in the process of moving all my music from Spotify to a different source, and we'll close down my Spotify because, you know, it might be a small and useless protest, but I feel good about it. But Bowie, you know, I'm a huge Bowie fan. I mean, Let's Dance, you know, everything from the Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust up until Dark Star 2 days before he died. I thought the guy was a musical genius.
He was.
Apart
from Tin Machine, it was just brilliant.
Yeah, that was a bit.
I went to see
experimental
Tin Machine live, and it was it was hard. It was hard. And I also went on the Glass Spider tour.
Yeah, I saw Glass Spider and Serious Moonlight, and I was
Serious Moonlight was a great tour.
Oh, fantastic! Absolutely fantastic.
Glass Spider was a bit of a misstep. You know, theatre in a stadium doesn't quite work. you know, I'm not going to knock him. He was genius, but Tin Machine was hard.
But the thing about him though is he wasn't afraid to try anything that he thought was something different to try.
My favorite quote of his is, you know, that, you know, you're doing something right when, you know, it's like swimming and you can't touch the bottom. You know, you go just to the point where you can't touch the bottom, and that's what you're trying to do creatively the whole time.
Yeah,
and I think that's
if you like, supplied a lot of the sort of the music of my youth. I'm just going to try and find this quote that I got from him that I thought was absolutely apropos. You have to forgive me scrolling through. Here we go. Aging is an extraordinary process where you become the person you always should have been.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And I just thought, wow. Yeah, that's really, yeah. You know, and I think maybe this last couple of years in the pandemic has given us that opportunity to be a little bit more reflective, to be a little bit more grateful for the things that we actually have. I've particularly found it an opportunity to have a little bit of self-care and reassessment, which has been great.
I've got to ask, Bex, what's the tune?
What, they'll get me on the dance floor?
Yeah.
Trying to think. So when I used to go to nightclubs, they were sort of nightclubs in our younger years, weren't they? They'd moved on from disco to nightclubs.
Right.
Probably something by the Smiths, I have to say.
Yeah. Because, you know, everyone else would be heading for the seats.
That's what I was going to say.
Or the bar.
You'd
be the one person up doing the Smiths, or the Cure or something like that.
I have a friend of mine is a DJ, and he said that if it's not going well and people aren't gelling very well and they're not dancing and they're not reacting, there's one song he knows is guaranteed to get people on the dance floor.
What's that?
Dancing Queen.
Yeah, that's true.
By ABBA.
That's true. That was always a fair
said,
safe.
All the women, they run for the dance floor as soon as he starts playing it.
I think I've told this story on the podcast before, but I DJ'd the end of tour party for Torvald and Dean in the mid-90s.
And oh, wow.
So, yeah. So they were holding this thing. They'd just been playing the West Point, which is a big barn in Exeter. And the Ukrainian dancing stars, or whatever they were called, all stars, were sitting around looking miserable. And they had various bits of tractor machinery and stuff like that that were taken back to their farms and their families back in. You know, it was very, they were all pouting. Torvald and Dean themselves had a massive stand-up row. And the only thing I could do to get anyone dancing, because no one was shifting, they'd obviously knackered after a long tour and they'd been ice skating and all this sort of thing, probably covered in bruises and all sorts of things that had gone on. I put on Ride on Time by Black Box.
Oh, yeah.
And that was just, you know, the whole party just suddenly lifted.
Yeah.
Follow that
yeah.
up with a bit of Bee Gees.
So it just takes one song.
It's something from Saturday Night Fever. You cannot lose. Those are Dancing Queen. That's the hydrogen bomb of getting the dance floor filled. I mean, that's your last resort, really. If you're really, really failing, get Dancing Queen on. But those things work. So,
Well, one of the most bizarre discos I've ever been to was, it was a really small venue, about the size of our living room, and the DJ was Mike Joyce from the Smiths.
Excellent.
And when he put the Smiths on, everybody went bananas.
Absolutely.
I'm hoping it wasn't Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now.
I think he did play that actually at some point.
Yeah. That's some good upbeat ones as well.
Yeah, it was really good fun.
So, Dead Drift is out. AJ Hill, yep. Andy Hill. It's such an exciting time, I know. One final question really is, in terms of subsequent books, where are you with, you know, book 2, 3, whatever?
So, yeah, book 2 is tentatively titled Bloody Butcher. And that will be Jack Lund 2. It's about 60,000 words in, so I've got about another 30,000, and it's projected to be out the latter end of the summer.
Wow, okay, good.
So PDQ. there'll be a third with Spellbound, and then hopefully they might renew my contract.
I'm sure they will. As ever, Andy, it's always a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so
much
for your
time. And we will see you at Crimefest, won't
we? We will see you.
Fantastic. Yeah, that'll be great. Look forward to it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Our pleasure. So Dead Drift out on ebook and paperback, and we wish Andy every success with it. And, we wish every debut author. I mean, it's such an exciting time, isn't it?
Yeah,
I'm still waiting for the chance to do that myself. But actually, if I got my act together and started writing, that would be great.
Well, you've been talking about it a bit today, so.
I have. Yeah, I was thinking, well, we were talking earlier about, and we will hear from her later, Lola L'Amour.
He's very taken with Lola L'Amour.
I am rather, yeah. Look, I mean, she's an expert on 40s fashion. She's passionate about it. It's on her website about how much she loves that period. And I need somebody to, as a consultant on 40s fashion for ladies, because I'm writing a story for which that plays a significant role. So I'm quite rather excited. I haven't approached it yet, but...
You only thought of it a couple of hours ago.
Yeah, I know. That's my life, isn't it? I just keep these ideas fizzing to my head. And now I've said it, I'm going to have to do it. So that's key. But no, it was that was a useful thing. So that was last night's party. I say, Dave Gorman, in action at the microphone to come.
And my dad too. He was very good sport about getting up on.
He was
singing and dancing and so yeah. I mean, he had a constant smile on his face. I think he had a really, really good evening because he's not been very well recently, has he? So it meant a lot to him.
It did mean a lot to him, and yeah, he's not well, and you know, the treatment's working pretty well considering, but. You know, occasions like this, you know, there aren't going to be that many more.
And it's not that many occasions when they get the whole family together. And they did. They had everybody, you know, both sides. So three children on my dad's side, four children on my stepmom's side, and all the add-ons and grandchildren and, you know, all the bits and
really
bobs.
Really sweet occasion. Really sweet. Now, this week, we had a conversation with last week's guest, Dan Morgan, and he was brilliant, wasn't he? I mean, we're talking, he's based in Canada now, and if you haven't read his blog on Medium, just go there because it's almost every day and it's just such amazing slabs of wisdom, really.
Mm.
An honest appraisal of the indie scene and how to sell books and things like that. So we had a really interesting conversation. He'd been obviously thinking a lot about the way we organise ourselves and the emphasis that we put on certain things and whether it's still the best practice or not. So that set us off thinking. And one of the things he suggested is that we really, you know, promote Hoback a little bit by getting more involved in some of the Facebook groups that love crime fiction. And so I've really just been down the rabbit hole.
You have a little bit, haven't you?
Yeah, with UK Crime Book Club, which has 21,000 or so followers.
But they're such a lovely bunch
of
people.
They're wonderful, and some great authors there on there commenting, and some of our own. You know, I've seen plenty of comments from our team, like Jonathan Peace as well,
and Brian.
And Brian, yeah, absolutely. So, Brian Price, it's been really fantastic. And I posed this morning a question of how do I improve my reading speed, because I've always been regarded, and I always regarded myself as a very slow reader. And I have to give credit to one of the members of the group who suggested that if you're left eye dominant, then you can only read one word at a time.
It makes sense, doesn't it? Because if you think about the way your left eye would have to scan each line.
I am left eye dominant. I did a test a couple of years ago trying to improve my darts, and there was a series of things, you know, you cover up your eyes individually and whatever. And it turns out, yeah, I'm left eye dominant.
I think I must be right eye dominant because my left eye is my lazy eye.
Yeah, right. So. Okay. So I can't read any quicker than actually taking it one word at a time, rather than some of the people who are mentioning in this, and there are hundreds of comments, it's amazing, are able to absorb pages almost at first glance.
Yeah, that's almost photographic memory,
yeah,
isn't it?
A little bit, yeah. But far, far quicker than I am at reading. And, you know, it's always bugged me because one of the things we used to be said at homework at primary school was go home and read 60 pages of X.
They would always say that, wouldn't they? Yeah,
yeah
read
yeah.
so
I
many
couldn't
pages.
Do it. It would take me hours to read 60 pages.
Well, that would be my ideal homework. I'd love it. I'd just go
hide
under the dining room table and do my homework.
I just remember when we were 10 years old and Lord of the Rings was a massive phenomenon amongst my peer group at that time. And that was the time when they brought out the radio production on Radio 4 with Michael Horden's Gandalf. It was amazing. And the competitions people used to have, get racing through the trilogy of books. I would always be stuck on the Fellowship of the Ring and everyone else had finished the rest of them because they just could read so much quicker.
I think at my school, we did that with Adrian Mole's diary.
Yeah.
Not quite so highbrow, but...
Yeah, I can understand that. But anyway, that was an interesting debate. We also brought up the subject this week of the ebook drop in sales for the Big Six. And, you know, interesting getting the insights of how people regard ebooks or versus physical copies.
Mm.
And yeah, there's a real need for physical copies amongst that particular
I found very interesting.
Social group, really.
Yeah, because I kind of assume that crime readers generally are ebook readers because of there's so many self-published and independent crime writers. But what was indicated in that conversation that actually the emphasis is more on physical books for a lot of these readers.
Yeah, but then there was a separate debate about the cost of books. And it was a pretty heated debate, as you can imagine. And a lot of us from the publishing side of things, explaining where their costs were, because people assume that all you have to do is write the book, stick it on the thing, and it costs you nothing to have it on an online platform, which is not true. First of all, that $2.99 price, for instance, which was being moaned about as being too expensive, 70% comes to you.
Mm.
If you're a solo author, that's not too bad, really, because it's just over £2. But to get people to buy your book, how much are you spending on marketing? And very often it's very much more than the royalty you're getting.
And also you've invested in editing.
Yes.
You may have invested in, it might only be an ebook cover, but not everybody does it themselves. So
no.
I'm probably sure, in fact, not many do, I think.
No.
So you could have invested up to £4,000 or £5,000 already.
Oh, yeah.
Before you even publish it.
Yeah.
So you need to.
And there's your
that.
Time. I mean, you know, this is A, your creativity, and B, your time. So why do people think it's okay to demand that everything comes down to 99p? And we have had a book this week, and it's, as we speak, coming off a 99p promotion with Silence from Jenny Enser. And I have to say, you know, you can shift a whole load of books at 99p, but there's next to no revenue from it. Mm. And so it's a big debate. But I do appreciate that some of the people who were corresponding in the group, UK Crime Book Club, were saying a lot of the traditional publishers have shoved up their prices on ebooks to almost the price of a paperback.
And that's true. They have.
Yeah. $5.99, $6.99, $7.99. As we've already reflected last week, you know, the cost of our production rate at Clay's is now 20% higher for a print run of books than it was 3 months ago. And I'm sorry to say, frankly, everything is going up, as we know. I mean, it's been absolutely an apocalypse of the living standards crisis in the UK.
Yeah.
Has overwhelmed so many people. And that is going to affect, obviously, sales. So a lot of people gravitating, I think, towards Kindle Unlimited, sort of holding their noses while they use a screen as opposed to a physical book.
Yeah.
But it does mean they get access to a lot more. It's very good value at whatever it is. To
be
an Amazon, and you get Kindle Unlimited as an Amazon Prime member.
And also, I mean, Audible.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that's as good value because you're only getting one book.
Okay.
And depending on the length. What a lot of people have, we've talked about this before, have been handing back their audiobooks having listened to them and then getting a refund. And this was causing, you know, everyone who was making audiobooks via Audible weren't getting any money, which was ridiculous. Some people were in minus territory.
It's shocking.
You know, to actually owe money.
I would never do that. Even if I didn't like the book,
they
I would never do that.
They are tremendous value at audiobooks. Because, I mean, the full price audiobook production when they were in CDs, well, you know, a 4-CD pack would cost you £30.
Yes. Yeah, I remember getting them from service stations.
As I know, having, you know, closed the production on Waking the Tiger by Mark Whiteman this week, and also we've seen Catch as Catchacan go up on Audible this week as well. Those productions took me months.
And it's hard work.
It's hard.
Very hard work.
Very hard work. Well, we'll hear from... when are we speaking to Diane Perry, by the way?
Actually, next week.
So our guest next week, we ought to mention this, is Diane Perry. Diane Perry is an American. She's based in London. She is a voiceover artist and expert, written a great book about voiceover and narration. We're really excited about speaking to her. But one of the things she did early on was she discovered that narrating audiobooks wasn't for her.
Yep.
She gives a lot of good advice about how to do it, but she didn't have
the... She just doesn't want to do it herself.
No, doesn't want to be stuck with it project for as long as it takes.
Because it's really, really hard work.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll read it. Well, she can tell us next week. But so Diane Perry joining us next week as our guest here on the Hobcast Book Show. We ought to wrap things up. We've got another busy week. Hopefully... At least one of our cars will be fixed.
Well, yeah, so you're having your car fixed tomorrow, with any luck.
And we'll get yours in to get whatever caused them total failure of the car.
Well, it was some sort of freak electrical...
Yeah, freak electrical glitch that meant that the dashboard didn't work.
It just shows how much...
A small issue.
A car these days relies on the electrics.
Well, not so much on the electronics, actually. It was an electronic fault more than an electric one.
Oh, is that different? What's the difference?
Yeah, because one of the chips was started.
No, what's the difference between electrics and electronics?
They're kind of related, but the electronics, because a lot of cars, one of the biggest problems for the supply of cars, we've gone down a rabbit hole now, in the world at the moment is a lack of chips for the central processing units of cars, or ECUs as they're called, that you get in cars. So most modern cars, well, they all have quite a lot of processing power literally under the bonnet that affect all the different systems. So if something goes wrong, it's not just a fuse going, it's usually a chip. So you remember I had a problem with my car, my Honda Jazz, and I had to have a whole new sort of brain put into it, which they got from Latvia.
Brain surgery.
Yeah. Anyway, let's
talking of chips, you wouldn't believe how many chips I found in the back of my car the other week.
I would. let's leave it for that. Let's get to what we've all been waiting for, which is an opportunity to hear the wonderful Lola Lamour, accompanied by John and Dave Gorman from last night. We'll leave you with that. Have a happy and creative week. Bye-bye. And if you should say goodbye, I still go on loving you. Each night I ask the stars above us. Why must I be a teenager in love? 've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.